Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, influential Florida musician Graham Parsons is being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
It is country and rock, isn't it? And I always thought he would get an induction on the countryside first. And it's going to be interesting to see who inducts him.
We'll discuss Florida as a borderland to other European colonies.
The politics of empire, whether Spanish or British, required those who called East Florida home to reassess their status within the politics of new regimes, develop new strategies of negotiation, and navigate the internal politics of their communities and tribes.
And we'll talk with Miami poet Ariel Francisco. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
There's a light, a certain kind of light that never shines on me.
Florida musician Graham Parsons is being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the musical influence category. Before his death in 1973, Parsons blended country and rock as a solo artist and with his band, the Flying Burrito Brothers. He directly influenced other artists, including the Byrds, the Rolling Stones, and the Eagles, and launched the career of Emmylou Harris. Bob Keeling is author of the book Calling Me Home, Graham Parsons and the Roots of Country Rock.
It's wonderful, and it was unexpected, and I also feel like it's certainly about time. And I hope this is the first step. Then I hope he's also inducted as an artist, and I also hope that this means the Country Music Hall of Fame isn't far away either. But it's wonderful that a Florida-born sort of a unicorn artist like Graham is getting his due, and just happy for all the stalwart fans of his music. And it's just great to see. It kind of came out of nowhere. What a pleasant surprise.
Graham Parsons was born in Winter Haven, Florida in 1946 to a citrus family with deep roots in the state.
Graham's life, you know, having been born in Winter Haven, being part of a really wealthy citrus family. In fact, they own the land that the theme park Legoland is situated on now. And it's kind of a Faulkner-esque novel type childhood for Graham. But money didn't buy happiness. And there was a vein of alcoholism throughout the family. And Graham did not have an easy life just because his family had money, far from it. But he was also fortunate to grow up in a very musical environment. First it was there in Winter Haven. Then he was up in Waycross, Georgia for several years, but then was back down and his family moved back to Winter Haven. And there was just such a musical environment there, this sort of 5-mile space between Auburndale and Winter Haven. You know, you had people like Bobby Braddock from there, the Country Music Hall of Fame songwriter. You had Les Dudek, great guitarist who ended up playing in the Allman Brothers, at least on their recordings after Duane Allman died. Just a number of really noted musical figures. And there was this wonderful environment that Graham grew up on. So he was able to join bands as a teenager with guys like Jim Stafford, who was a brilliant guitarist, and be able to tour throughout the state as a teenager, and that really helped nurture him as an artist. So when he went out to the West Coast, kind of fell into the birds in 1968, he was ready to go, and he had a musical vision that he brought to them.
After getting an early musical start in Central Florida with his band The Shilohs, Gram Parsons and Chris Hillman from The Byrds worked on several projects together.
Gram started out as a folkie, as so many of those artists did, including Chris Hillman, Roger McGuinn, these guys from The Byrds. But within about a three-year period, let's say 66 to 69, Gram evolved from being a folkie with the band The Shilohs. And then, as I mentioned, he ended up being asked to join The Byrds as a sideman in 1968. That was short-lived. And then he was so much into country that, as was Chris Hillman, that they decided to start really what was the archetypical country rock band called the Flying Burrito Brothers in 69. And enormously influential. So yeah, Gram covered a lot of genres in a short time.
This old town filled with sin, it'll swallow you in if you got some money to burn. Take it home right away.
Another Floridian, Bernie Ledden of the Eagles, also worked with and was influenced by Gram Parsons.
Bernie's another guy who covered a lot of ground in a short amount of time. And after Gram left the Burritos to go solo in the early 70s, here comes Bernie Ledden. And, they're backing up Linda Ronstadt at the time. And all of a sudden, yeah, she says, okay, yeah, you guys go ahead and you're free to start your own band, and that band becomes the Eagles. So yeah, there was quite a mixture of sort of these same fellow travelers in these enormously influential bands, and Gram was right at the center of that scene for a while.
Country and Americana artist Emmylou Harris got her start with Gram Parsons. Bob Keeling.
Gram discovered her in a bar in Georgetown called Clyde's. And a couple of his bandmates, Chris Hillman being one of them, former bandmates, were in there and saw her and said, "Gram, you gotta see this girl singer," is how they put it back in the day. And Gram was looking for that sensibility for his solo records because he wanted to have a woman singer to play off of, and that's how Emmylou got her start. And boy, the rest is history. Even though they only made two records together in 1972 and 73, GP was the first one and Grievous Angel was the second, both rated 5 stars by Rolling Stone magazine.
Rolling Stone magazine also ranked Gram Parsons number 87 on their list of the 100 greatest artists of all time. Rolling Stone band member Keith Richards credits his friend Gram Parsons with influencing the sound of his band. The Stones gave the song Wild Horses to Parsons' band, the Flying Burrito Brothers, to record first. Many bands that Gram Parsons influenced, like the Rolling Stones and the Eagles, had much more commercial success than he did, but the country rock genre would not have developed the way it did without him.
Well, he certainly provided the blueprint, and it's so interesting what you've covered here in this interview. It is country and rock, isn't it? And I always thought he would get an induction on the country side first, and it's going to be interesting to see who inducts him. I just read an interview with Graham's daughter, Polly, online on Rolling Stone, and she's hoping that perhaps it'll be Keith Richards and Emmylou Harris, which would be wonderful because it represents the standard bearers of both the country and the rock genres. And Gram managed to bridge those two. And so many artists were influenced by him, Tom Petty, REM, to name a couple of them, Jay Farrar and Sunvolt, Steve Earle. And of course, Emmy Lou carried the torch after Graham's untimely death at just 26 years old. And she took his vision and her own, of course, all the way to the Country Music Hall of Fame.
Graham Parsons died in 1973 from an accidental drug and alcohol overdose. Adding to the tragedy was the fact that a friend stole his body and attempted a cremation at Joshua Tree National Park. Bob Keeling.
That happened to Graham after his death. It's kind of an unfortunate story, really, that his body was actually stolen by a road manager named Phil Kaufman and taken out to Joshua Tree, as he said Graham wanted to have this sort of a funeral pyre out in the desert. And while it sounds like this heroic rock and roll story, the reality was Kaufman basically abandoned his remains and they ended up being discovered by park rangers. And it was his stepsister's birthday when all of this happened, and it caused a great deal of pain to Graham's family. And one of the things I've tried to do in writing my book, you know, Calling Me Home, Graham Parsons and the Roots of Country Rock, is to bring his story back to the South, back here to Florida, to concentrate on his timeless and transcendent music and move away from that story, which, you know, dwarfed his legitimate legacy as such an influential artist. And so it really is wonderful to see him being recognized in that way, a little late, some would say, by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but better late than never, that's for sure.
Graham Parsons' legacy as an influential figure in country rock is also recognized at Derry Down, an historic concert venue in Winter Haven, where Parsons played as a teenager. Musician Jim Carlton introduced Bob Keeling to Derry Down and other clubs that comprised a youth circuit in Florida.
The more I researched it, the more I realized the amount of really influential musicians beyond Graham who you know, cut their teeth this way, to include Tom Petty, to include Duane and Greg Allman. You talked about Bernie Ledden, Don Felder from the Eagles, the guys from Lynyrd Skynyrd. They all toured this type of circuit. And after I wrote about it in the book, it was this wonderful grassroots movement starting with Main Street, Winter Haven. And a fellow who's a good friend of mine, Gene Owen, who came up with the idea of, you know, restoring this place and turning it into a historic listening room. And indeed, that's what it has become in the last, you know, 12 or 13 years. It's also a Florida Heritage Site. And I'm really proud to say that several years back, we hosted Chris Hillman to play there. And that was a night I will never forget. But yeah, it's a living tribute to Graham's musical legacy right there in the town where he was born in Winter Haven.
Bob Keeling is author of the book Calling Me Home, Graham Parsons and the Roots of Country Rock. Graham Parsons is being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the musical influence category. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to watch our public television series Florida Frontiers and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, in the second half of the 18th century, Florida changed hands twice, shifting from Spanish to British control at the end of the French and Indian War in 1763, and back to Spanish control in 1784, following the Peace of Paris that concluded the American Revolution. The Spanish and British had very different expectations for Florida and the indigenous people who lived there.
In a fall 2015 Florida Historical Quarterly article titled "Reconstructing Power in an American Borderland," Nancy O. Gallman, at the time a Ph.D. candidate at the University of California, Davis, navigated the complexities of the two transitions in power in to provide a compelling interpretation of the barriers and opportunities for settlers, enslaved people, and indigenous tribes. The politics of empire, whether Spanish or British, required those who called East Florida home to reassess their status within the politics of new regimes, develop new strategies of negotiation, and navigate the internal politics of their communities and tribes. As Gallman argues, the several transitions of empire reshaped the politics of Florida in ways that shaped the peninsula well into the 19th century. According to Gallman, Spain and Great Britain shared two goals in their colonization efforts in North America. Quote, "They wanted to expand the extent of their power and wealth and to establish a colonial social order which they would define and control," end quote. However, neither empire had free rein in achieving their goals. At the beginning of the 18th century, indigenous people outnumbered Europeans in the southeast by 10 to 1. In East Florida in 1775, the Creek population was five times that of the European. As a result, negotiations between Europeans and native populations took place on native ground, with indigenous people, quote, "controlling much of the context and the terms of negotiation." Although both European powers shared some common goals, they differed considerably in what colonization meant in practical terms. Gallman explained that, quote, "Spain struggled to assert its sovereignty over the Florida colony," end quote, but needed the peninsula to, quote, "claim control over the Gulf economy and to protect the Spanish treasure fleet from rival attacks as it traveled between the Caribbean and Europe," end quote. Spain established few settlements in Florida and valued native people as, quote, "potential spiritual converts and as allies in the defense of East Florida against British intrusion," end quote. Britain acted on a different vision of empire, quote, "rooted in a fundamental belief about private property that shaped Anglo-American political identity," end quote. They acted on that view in two ways, establishing settlements of farmers and planters and engaging with indigenous people as trading partners, while simultaneously seeking to persuade them to relinquish their tribal lands to new settlers.
Connie, historians traditionally focused on the European actions and largely viewed native people as acted upon, not as actors in the struggles between empires. Modern historians recognize that they were quite adept at diplomacy and at playing one power against the other.
As Gallman explains, quote, "by the middle of the 18th century, the Lower Creek tradition of persuasion and consensus sustained tension between and within their towns. Because it enabled the Lower Creeks to weigh their opportunities and risks, this tension supported their autonomy from each other and from Europeans," end quote. Even as they sought protection from the Carolina slave traders, they, quote, "enacted a policy of political neutrality and ambivalence, taking advantage of both Spanish and British trade and diplomacy when it benefited them," end quote. Once the British gained control over East Florida in 1763 and the French were removed from the lower Mississippi region, Spanish claims shifted westward, and the landscape for negotiation developed in new contexts. Britain became the lone power in the southeast region and moved to convert Indian land into British territory. With the previous balance of power destroyed, indigenous nations pushed back, most notably in what has been labeled as Pontiac's Rebellion. Lower Creeks and Seminoles in East Florida witnessed two important changes in their interactions with the British. No longer competing with the Spanish for native trade, British merchants raised prices, lowered quality, and engaged in abusive practices. In addition, pressure on the land increased. In response to violence in the West, the British government established a proclamation line at the crest of the Appalachians and forbade settlement west of the line. Although the settlers largely ignored the new border, East Florida now contained the largest amount of land east of the proclamation line and became, quote, a promising new source for British settlement, end quote. In 1765, British Governor James Grant met with Creek and Seminole leaders at Fort Picolata, a Spanish-built fort west of St. Augustine. The resulting treaty favored the British, with Creeks and Seminoles losing control over more than 2 million acres of land and ushering in, quote, the next era of European-Native diplomatic relationships that emphasized land speculation most, trade and military alliances less, and Christian missionizing not at all, end quote. Although the British acquired the land they coveted, their efforts to establish a plantation economy largely failed. Gallman concludes, quote, the European policy of controlled inclusion gave way to a new policy of controlled exclusion, familiar with generations of colonial experiences in North America. The British imported the force of its principles to the new colony of East Florida, where officials and planters gradually cleared the land of trees and native peoples and made room for the rise of a disruptive plantation economy. In the years to come, this economy would generate more disorder and change in this restless borderland. For the British Empire's loyal and rebellious subjects who contested it, the Spanish who coveted it, when they returned, the Africans who lost their lives to it, the native peoples who resisted it, and the new republicans who forced it into the realm of a new kind of empire, end quote.
Thank you, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Poet Ariel Francisco grew up in Miami and earned a master's degree in fine arts and poetry at Florida International University. In his latest book of poetry, All the Places We Love Have Been Left in Ruins, Francisco reflects on the changes he's seen in Miami in the past couple of decades.
Miami is constantly getting a makeover. Everything is constantly under construction. Different people moving in, moving out. So it's beautiful and horrible the way it's just kind of constantly morphing. And I don't know if adapting is the right word, but it's a city constantly in flux, which is part of what makes it great, part of what makes it awful.
In the poem, Even Churchill's is Closing, Ariel Francisco remembers the good times he had in a popular music venue that is now demolished.
So we used to go out there when I was maybe between like 19 and 22, and what a place. I mean, we just get hammered and just watch whatever band happened to be playing. That's not my scene at all, really. But one of my buddies was like, we got to go out there. We used to love this band, the Jacuzzi Boys, who are a local band. I don't know if they're still making music, but it was like a surf rock type band. Hey, man, what's the news? Cracking up. How about you? Spacing out. Yeah, me too. Rolling on. And it was just a blast. And it was such a weird kind of pub atmosphere. I mean, they had the soccer games on all the time, especially in the middle of the night, because I guess they'd be playing in Europe, right? And just all kinds of strange bands. They used to have some kind of noise conference there. So it was all like this weird noise music that sounded like a giant air conditioner shutting down. But it was just a place with so much character and just so many different kinds of people there. It was a lot of fun. It was disgusting. That wasn't a joke about how, you know, it seemed like how infrequently it was cleaned. But it was always had a good time there. Just a lot of good people, a lot of good music, and just the kind of chaos that is very particular to Miami, I think, was very alive at Churchill's.
Francisco presents his poems in both Spanish and English. In the poem Insomniami, he describes Miami as a city with a history of hurricanes and fraud.
I've always thought that it's really a microcosm of everything that's wrong with the country in general. But I don't want to only speak ill of it, but that's kind of a lot of what perpetuated that poem was, like the actual sleeplessness of my 20s paired with just thinking about all of this. It feels like a sinking ship. It really does. But like nobody seems to care. You know, they're just like, no, it's fine. It's just you want to ride it out as long as you can. And that's a crazy way to run a city, to run a state.
Ariel Francisco discussed his new book of poetry, All the Places We Love Have Been Left in Ruins, at the Miami Book Fair. He first attended the event at age 11 and has appeared there several times as an author.
It's absurd that such a rich literary, not even event, but like circus in a good way, happens in such a place with all these problems, all these political problems, all these climate problems. But then you have like this art-centric, book-centric, gigantic event taking place in the heart of it. While they're banning books, right? It's really... Again, it's peak Miami to have both things simultaneously, to have one of the largest, I think it's the largest book fair in the country, if not one of the largest, paired with all these insane politicians who are actively banning books and causing all these problems. For those two things to exist at once is very Miami, I think. But the book fair is just the best, man. It's how do you not spend all your money here? You know, it brings my favorite people together, which is people who spend all their money on books. Are at the Miami Book Fair, and that's who I am, and that's who I want to be around.
Miami poet Ariel Francisco's latest work is called All the Places We Love Have Been Left in Ruins. You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and anytime at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.